You're listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves.
Welcome to Atlanta Baseball Talk, show number 354. Today is Sunday, October 9th, 2016, and my name is Steve. I'm joined by both Hammy and Kurt, and guys, in tonight's show, we'll discuss the end of the Roger McDowell era and look back at our start of the season predictions. We will start, though, with our sit-down interview with David O'Brien, but first, a quick break. So we had the pleasure earlier today of sitting down with David O'Brien, beat writer for the AJC. Let's take a listen. We're very happy to welcome David O'Brien, Braves beat writer for the AJC and a must follow on Twitter at DOBrienAJC. David, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, doing great. So, David, regarding the Braves moving on from Roger McDowell, how likely do you think it is that the front office acted on this in tandem with a manager that's already been chosen?
I think that the front office was going to act on this either way, whether they stayed with Snitker or hired a new manager, because they had become frustrated, not just this year, but the past few years with, even though they gave Roger a 2-year extension, 4 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, but they had become frustrated with the lack of development of certain young pitchers, particularly the last couple of years, because there for a while you had the Chris Medlins and Mike Minor came along well before he got hurt. But the last couple of years, they haven't seen many or any of their young guys step forward. And with so much emphasis being put on pitching prospects going forward from here, they've done the whole foundation for this rebuild is on the backs of pitching for the most part, like it was in the past, getting back to quote unquote the Braves way. That's part of it, the pitching foundation. And they didn't feel comfortable turning over all these pitchers when they got here, in spring training. And then when they got to the major league level during the season, turning them over to Roger, they just thought they'd be better suited getting a pitching coach whose main strength or one of his main strengths was the development of young pitchers rather than working with veteran pitchers, which Roger, without question, is exemplary at that part of the job.
Do you think there's anything to the, Medlin and Beachy having multiple Tommy John surgeries, anything about his handling of pitchers leading to injuries?
I don't know. And I think anybody other than a doctor, and maybe even some doctors who would, but anybody else who would profess to know, who would try to point a finger at Roger for those, I think is a fool. I think they're just trying to be, they're trying to state opinions that are nothing more than that, or opinions based on no scientific fact and based on nothing that they know about how Roger develops pitchers to believe that there's a reason why those guys would get hurt. I've watched these guys and I've covered many other pitching coaches over the last 22 years. And there is nothing that Roger does with these guys and nothing that these pitchers have told me that Roger does with them. Most importantly, the pitchers themselves, including the guys you just mentioned, the guys who've had smoked to Tommy John's apiece. Nothing that they've done in this program that they didn't do in other programs or programs that either in the past or once they went to from here that they said, now I understand why I got hurt. Nothing like that has ever occurred. So if the pitchers themselves don't know and doctors don't know, then I think for any of us to try to say that there's something there is just stupid. Now you could point to overuse. One thing you can point to is overuse in the bullpen for a while there, especially with both Bobby Cox and Freddie Gonzalez, with some guys who ended up getting hurt, undoubtedly had huge numbers of appearances and were overused. Guys like Peter Moylan. For the year that he, a couple of years that he had, including one when he came back from his first time at John. You can cite that. But as far as the development of guys coming up, and then like Chris Medlin, when he got hurt, there was nothing about how Chris Medlin was used that would that you could point to as a reason for having a second time at John. And I'm not going to put that at Roger's feet. I'm not going to do that.
So, David, there's this potential benefit you're going to get with someone who's not so tough love driven, however you want to describe Roger, with the rookie pitchers coming up, and then the benefit that you obviously saw with Roger with the veterans. Do you think the potential good outweighs having kept him?
I don't know. I guess we're going to find out. I don't know necessarily that it was a tough love. I know he butted heads, obviously, with Julio Teheran, but you don't find many other guys at all, prominent guys, who had a problem with how he handled them as far as that's concerned, the mental aspect of it. I think it points more towards the pitcher. Now, in the case of Julio Teheran, obviously, I'm not saying it's a flaw with him, but if a pitcher really can't overcome, a guy being a little less than coddling, then that says more about the pitcher, I think, than about the pitching coach. I mean, how far are you going to get with guys like that? I don't think Dom Glavine and John Smoltz were guys who would have let whoever complained about any tough love or. And they both had pitching coaches along the way that were, Leo Mazzoni. He didn't coddle guys. He had a way of doing things, but he didn't coddle guys. So I think it's more in the approach the way they go about things between starts and just maybe the advice that he has, which works for those guys who come at it at, like Medlin told me, Medlin looked at the fact that Roger had been there, pitched for 15 years or however long he pitched in the majors, and came into it with that in mind that, hey, I have this respect for this guy because he's been through it. So when he has some advice or he has some points out something to me, I'm going to listen because he can help me. So maybe if you go into it with that in mind, but if you don't, if you go into it not with disregard for what Roger did in the past and just prove it to me type of mentality, then maybe you'll have a problem with him rather than taking the advice. So, but I understand why the organization is making this move, because other than Julio Teheran, I mean, you'd be kind of hard pressed to find a pitcher they have now or in the past couple of years, a young guy who has really developed, and who you would say much less overachieved, but I'm just saying one who fully developed into what they thought he was going to be. I mean, they've been few and far between lately. So, I can see where they'd want to make a move, because like I said, they're going to lean so much on those guys, more so in the coming years than they have in the past few years. And longer than that, where they used to plug holes or bring in guys who, Leo Mazzoni was a master at bringing in guys off the scrap heap and guys who needed a change of scenery and turning them back into what they were or better than they ever were before. So they're not going to really need that kind of pitching coach here for the next 5-10 years. They're going to rely so heavily on the guys they've drafted and that they've acquired in trades to carry the bulk of the load for this pitching staff.
Yeah. So David, a few years ago, after Chipper had left, after David Ross had left, there were stories a lot about there's no leadership in the clubhouse. That was a big topic. And I remember Freddie Gonzalez coming out and saying he doesn't really get involved in the clubhouse. Is this year, was Snitker more of a clubhouse guy, or if not, what was it about his personality that led to that really, overwhelming support he got from the players?
You hardly ever saw Snitker walk through the clubhouse and talk to guys in the clubhouse or sit down. I mean, literally, if you're looking for that. And you never saw Bobby Cox do it. It's a fine line, and it's a mix that you either character trait that you either have or you don't, an ability that you have or you don't. And that is to get to know the guys you need to get the confidence in right away. The key guys in the clubhouse, the vocal guys, the guys who are leaders, you need to have them on your side right away. Particularly, one or two in every clubhouse. But if you can have, five or six, all those guys, you get those guys believing in you. It disseminates to all the guys in the clubhouse. The other guys tend to listen to those guys and take their cues from those guys. So they have, okay, if he likes him, okay, I'm going to give him a shot. If so-and-so likes him, then if Nick Markakis likes this guy, or Jeff Francoeur speaks so highly of this guy, or Freddie Freeman says he knew him since Double A and loved this guy, they go into it right away with a positive vibe of, you know, until he shows me otherwise, I'm going to, they go into it with a good feeling about a guy. As opposed to if you maybe are brusque or you don't have a good relationship with one or two key guys, that guy can tell a couple other guys, I don't like this guy because of this and that. And those things can fester in a clubhouse. Now you add losing to that and it multiplies everything. On the other hand, you add winning to it, then it can be a salve for everything, or it can mask little fires in the clubhouse. So there's just the clubhouse is a very complicated place that people who dismiss it. That's why I always get so upset when I hear people dismiss clubhouse chemistry, because they don't understand, because they haven't either been in there, watched it every day. Even if, you know, by watching it, I mean just talk to guys every day, be literally in the clubhouse before games, talk to the guys, see their immediate reactions after games, see how they roll their eyes or body language when they're talking to you and giving you official quotes. You know, all this little stuff. And people that dismiss what happens in a clubhouse aren't getting it, because they think, you know, they point to the 25 Cavs Yankees, who all none of whom had liked each other supposedly, and they had all these, you know, Billy Martin fought with everybody and all this. Okay, you can do that when you have far more talent than everybody else and you just overwhelm people with talent. You can do that. But most teams aren't like that. 99.9% of teams are not like that, especially in this day and age. So there's parity. So a clubhouse is more important than ever. And getting back to your question, personality goes a long way. If you have a personality, I mean, just like people are popular, some people are more popular than others. We see that in all aspects of life. A guy like Snitker, like a guy like Bobby Cox, they're different personalities, but they're similar in a lot of ways when it comes to managing. Snitker, for one thing, has this personality that's impossible not to like. If he wasn't a manager, you just met him and he was a friend of yours or a neighbor, everybody would like him. So that goes a long way to begin with. Everybody likes him. Then he's got to prove himself, obviously. So then he goes from, you know, that personality, which immediately people ingratiates people. People like him. People think he's a friendly fella. Now he's an older guy. But even when he was a younger guy, people liked him because he's just a folksy guy that loves to engage in conversation, looks you in the eye when you're talking, is interested, doesn't interrupt, all this kind of thing. So people like him. So then you add the fact that of 40 years he's been in baseball, professional baseball, as player, manager, coach at every level in the minors. He's been through it all. He wasn't a great player. He was a minor league player. That's another aspect of most great managers weren't great players. Most of them are like Jim Leland and Bobby Cox. Bobby Cox would have been supposed to be a great prospect, but never amounted much in the major league level. But most of them didn't even get that far. So the average player can identify with him, and he thinks that guy can identify with them. He's been there. He's been through the wars. He's grinded it out, all this. Snitker's got all that going for him, all those aspects going for him. And then he comes in, and from day one, he communicates. That's the most important thing, is communication. Making guys feel like you're listening to them, you can talk to them, you can tell them, and letting them know what's going on and where they stand, not making them go ask other people where they stand or what you're thinking. You let them know, you tell them, and you have an open door type policy that they can come in if they still don't understand, you know, quite what's going on, and you'll answer them. Snitker's really honest in that regard. He'll tell a guy, you're not going to get a whole lot of bats, because these three guys that are playing the outfield right now are all veterans who are all playing well. If they were struggling, it'd be one thing, but they're all playing well. The team's clicking now. So I know you lost your position because of injury, but that doesn't mean you're going to come back in and move in the starting lineup. You're not going to. So he tells guys what they need to hear, whether they want to hear it or not, or whether it's good or bad. He tells them. They respect that. Guys respect being told their position, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. Or they respect being told, rather than you trying to put rose-colored glasses on or blowing smoke up their butts, because they know. They're smart. Mm. So he's got all of that going for him. I hope I'm covering all the bases, but that's why everybody likes him. And then he's proven that he knows what he's doing. I mean, and he has their backs. He has their backs. He showed from day one that he will come out on the field and argue and have their backs. They love that. You know, you might think it's a small matter, but it's not. They loved it. Seeing that Bobby Cox was the king of that. Bobby Cox fought for them. Bobby Cox might not even have seen the call, his guy was in an argument with an umpire. He was on the field arguing with, for his guys. And they love feeling like you have their backs all the time, regardless of the situation.
So, David, why do you think the front office did give the job to Brian Snitker over TP or Eddie or Bo in the middle of the season? Was he a sacrificial lamb who ended up just doing really well?
No, I don't think he was a sacrificial lamb. I think that's putting it a bit harsh. I think he's a company man, though. He'd been there 40 years. It was a very – it looked like a no-win situation. To be honest, right. I didn't think anybody could come in and succeed in that situation. So I think they looked at it as, with Snitker, we know he's going to come in. He's going to get the best out of it that he can. Maybe they didn't think it was going to be much. Maybe they did think he could turn it around. You know, they're not going to probably be honest and say but they did. Even Hart said, you know, the other day that he didn't just make the best of a situation. He did a dramatic turnaround. So he did surpass all their expectations. But I think they looked at Snitker and said, we're going to bring him up from AAA. We can stick him in this job. He'll at least get us, you know, try to smooth the waters and get us through the season without any more disasters happening. The players are going to like him. That'll be good. You know, there won't be any kind of the clubhouse will become more fractured. It'll get better if nothing else. Whether on the field gets better, we don't know. But at the end of the year, Snitker is going to be the same guy that he was, and we can move him right back to AAA if we want to. We can do whatever. We've not sacrificed this guy and made it such that as some interim guys, when they're done, there's nowhere for them to go. You know, you can't move them back to the position they were in because they're now contaminated or toxic or it's a bad feeling, you know, or whatever. With him, they knew they could just move him back to AAA if they wanted to, or back on the major league coaching staff if that's what they knew, that nothing was going to happen long term, that he wasn't a guy they were going to sacrifice. Whereas Terry Pendleton and Eddie Perez both want to be managers. They and the front office knows this. To stick one of them in that situation, it would have been really awkward, for one thing, because they're moving up. It looks like, you know, some guys feel like they're stabbing their boss's back when they move them from the coaching staff. It happens all the time anyway. I mean, you have to do it if they ask you to do it. But they didn't feel like they were putting either of those guys in a position to succeed in what would have been their first managerial stint. I mean, if you put Terry Pendleton in that, a guy they respect so much, who has been a finalist for some major league jobs over the years. So all of a sudden he takes over this team. And what if they go, you know, whatever the, however many number of games there were left, but what if he goes 30 and, 70 or whatever it was, 30 and 80 the rest of the way, with a team that keeps up the pace that Freddie was on? What does that look like when he tries to get a job with another team, you know, and how does he smooth the waters with this team? And it's just, it wasn't a good situation it wasn't fair to ask either of those guys that were on that coaching staff of that team that was 9-28 and both of whom wanted that job to step into that. And Bo Porter too had managed with the Astros and gotten fired there in a kind of an odd situation. And here he would be plugging him back in another bad situation and I don't think they felt that he had the kind of relationship with the players who could turn things around, if that's what they hope to do, or even get them through the season on a better note than they were at 9-28.
Right. So, Dave, I want to move on to Matt Kemp for a second. So he was really demonstrative on his first day as a Brave in that piece in the Players Journal about his recommitment to the game, you know, first there, last to leave. Did you see that in him day to day in his time with the Braves this year?
I saw nothing but good. I mean, I expected, you know, like a lot of people, you know, you hear some stories about how he'd become kind of aloof, not a distraction, but not really getting along with certain players or maybe a me first type guy. But I saw none of that, and neither did the players that I talked to from the first day he was here. He didn't make a scene. He didn't expect to be, you know, treated like a star. He didn't. You know, he's quiet. You have to go over to him and ask him for an interview. And if you ask him, he says sure and talks. But he didn't strike me at all as the kind of guy, a big star who'd been a former, should have won the MVP the year that he was a runner up to Braun, in my opinion. But anyway, a guy who dated Hollywood stars, celebrities, and you know, lived in the Hollywood Hills and all that in a mansion. He didn't strike me as that at all. He struck me as a guy who wanted to come in, and like you said in that story, that piece that he wrote, wanted to come in and start over and prove to people that he could be the good teammate that he was, you know, early in his career and the player that he was. So I don't know that anybody in the clubhouse didn't like him. Like Freddie Freeman instantly became attached to the guy and really likes him and genuinely likes him. So that was huge because those are the two biggest, you know, position players on the team and biggest stars on the team. And for them to get along and batting, you know, one in front of the other, it's key. But he came in and did what he said he was going to do. Now, I don't know how sincere he was when he wrote it. You know, the Padres owner didn't seem to think he was, but
right.
Let's just put it this way. I never saw him do something or act in a way with us or whatever that I walked away going, oh, so much for that Flyers Tribune piece that he wrote. Because he really didn't. He was fine. I mean, was he the first guy in and out on the field doing extra work? I didn't see that, but I saw him do everything everybody else did and work hard. He came in overweight. There's no doubt about that. And that struck me right away as I went, God, I don't remember it being like this out of shape or this overweight. That struck me. But having said that, it didn't seem to affect him a great deal on the field, except in the first couple of weeks in left field. And I don't know how much of that was getting adjusted to left field and the angles of the ball coming off the back. He hadn't played the position in a long time. And he looked pretty bad out there in the first couple of weeks. But after that, he wasn't going to win a Gold Glove, but he caught all the balls basically that he should have caught after those first couple of weeks. And at the plate, he surpassed my expectations. I thought he looked good. If he loses some weight this offseason, I think he can get back. Because I thought he was going to come in and be hobbling basically because of the hips, the knees, all the ankle problems he's had. And I didn't see that. I saw a guy that if he were to lose, you know, 20 pounds, it might be a great deal of relief, even more on those hips that, like I said, I didn't see him bothered by the hips and all that, like I thought I was going to see. So if he were to lose 20 pounds, I think he could be, and he had a hell of a year with the Braves, even a little overweight, obviously. But who knows what he could do if he loses some weight and comes back out in the outfield, maybe getting a few more balls, you know, down in the gaps and on the line, that kind of thing. It helps have an NCRT, that's for sure. But, I was nothing but, impressed by him. I like the guy. I think he's a good guy. Talking to him, I think he's a good guy. He's got a good personality that gets along with other guys. I mean, he's, you know, you can tell he's a star and he's got a little bit of that in him, but he gets along great with the other guys and he talks to all the guys. He doesn't, you know, act like, you know, he can't talk to the 25th guy on the team or any of that. Cause he does, he engages with all of them. I saw that from day one.
And I'm admittedly a sucker for a spring training best shape of his life story. But seriously, if he comes in 20 pounds less next year, it really will be something. I mean, there'll be a lot of excitement about that.
Even 10 pounds, you know?
Yeah.
At his age, he's not an old guy. I mean, right. If he hadn't had all the injuries, you wouldn't even look at him as a guy who was on the downside of his career. He should still be in the back end of the prime of his career.
Yep.
So you look at the numbers he put up this year, and you think if he was in really good shape, because he still, say this about him, he might have been overweight, but he was out there playing every day. Unlike some guys, he doesn't let little aches and pains keep him out of the lineup, and I really respected that because I'd looked at some of the years he'd had where he only played 100 games or whatever it was, but he had major injuries in those years. With the nagging stuff, he plays every day. He doesn't want to come out of the lineup. He played every game for the Braves when he's here, and I started all but one or two of them, so that impressed me right away. He never went to snicker after playing, you know, the first 40 games and said, hey, how about a day off or something? Never did that. And that goes a long ways in the view of his teammates and his coaches.
So, David, we saw, you know, the best of Freddie Freeman, I think, in his offensive numbers overall, his increased power numbers. Are you ready to believe this is closer to the Freeman we'll see in the next few years, or was this an aberration?
Yes, I'm ready. I said we had this conversation last year before the one we have right before the season starts.
Yeah.
And I said then, I don't think people understand. I think people, we've seen him so much that we're so close to the situation that we take it for granted that people don't understand how special Freddie Freeman is. I said that then. this is a really special hitter, one of the best hitters in baseball. Naturally blessed, works hard, but, I mean, he has the gift of being able to hit, lightning in his hands. So, and now he's growing into his body and losing, he's lost the baby fat. He always had, he was a little bit soft because he just was so young. Yeah. He's lost that, and he's a big guy. The first thing people who have never met him before say, or even if they go to a game and he comes over near the railing or whatever, they're shocked at how big he is. They think, you know, from a distance, because he's kind of a proportion like a normal size guy, that he's probably 6 foot or 6'2". He's like 6'5". You know, look at the old pictures of him and Jason Hayward. He was Jason's size, you know, and now he's filled out and lost some of the kind of, for lack of a better term, baby fat. I don't know if it was baby fat, but he's gotten a little more lean, and he's not even a guy that has to lift a lot of weights or anything, but he does work hard, and he's a big guy with those lightning quick hands and the hand eye coordination that a great hitter has to have. He has, and he keeps it simple with his approach, which in the past prevented him from having long streaks. They can't say that anymore because this year he did have some terrible streaks in the first 2 months, the worst of his career. But man, once he got hot, you could argue that he was the best hitter in baseball after mid-June. If he wasn't, he was one of the best two or three for sure. So you can't fake it for months and months and months. You can fake it and have a great month or two. He did it for 4.5 months, basically. I mean, and after the All-Star break, he never had a stretch of more than 3 or 4 games where he was in what you would consider a slump. So I wouldn't say that you're going to project what he did for 4 months. You can't project that over 6 months and go, that's what he's going to be. But you can look at his year end numbers and go, he can be close to that. You know, I mean, he can be a guy who hits 280 with a close to a 400 OBP and close to a 500 slugging percentage, which, you know, you do that for 10, 15 years, you're in the Hall of Fame. So he's that good, though. And I don't think you're going to see any kind of drop-off unless he gets hurt. I mean, you can never predict that. But other than the 2 years that he had before this, or really a year, he was the kind of guy that played, you know, over 150 games every year and really closer to 162 because he wants to be in the lineup every day. He hates having even one day off. So that's another great, like I said about Kemp, having guys at LA and Markakis, having guys that want to play every day and them being your biggest stars, your veterans, that's huge. When they want to play every day, that's huge.
It was such a dreadful start to the season.
Yes, it was.
You know, with Ibar not performing, Inciarte not hitting, and then it's still unbelievable to me how many fantastically good surprises there were in this team to end the year.
Yeah.
I'm still sort of dumbfounded by it. It must have been a joy for you to cover it after the start.
It was. We had people, you know, would come to us, Bowman and I, you know, we'd enter a press box, you know, on the road, you know, halfway through the season, and people go, oh, man, this must be a long season for you guys, right? Or you must be counting down the days. And we're like, you know what? We really aren't. I mean, after you got past the Freddie firing, that was a bad period because it was just dark cloud hanging over the team. It was unfair to everybody, unfair to Freddie. Because at a certain point, it was obvious he was going to get fired. Front office was doing nothing to kind of quash those rumors, you know, not giving him any support, any of that, vote of confidence, all that. So you knew he was going to get fired. So you had a period of a few weeks where it was just inevitable. And there was no way the team was going to overcome that. Everybody was waiting. They were being asked about it. So once he got him fired, Snicker stepped in. From day one, there was a different mood in the clubhouse. He's known all these guys like Francoeur and Kelly Johnson was here at the time and Freeman, all these guys. He's known them since the minor leagues, and they all liked him. So there was immediate, like, this breath of fresh air, or the cloud had departed that was over the team. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, we got a terrible record. Snicker's managing now. You know, we at least know we're going to enjoy the rest of the season, that, win, lose, or draw each day, we're going to, you know, it's going to be a different atmosphere. So, and we're not going to, he's not going to bring in the 9-28 record. It's not going to matter going forward. So then you got all these guys that it was amazing how many guys had struggled at one time or were hurt in NCRT's case during that first month and a half of the season. I mean, God, it was, you know, to Freddie's, to in defense of Freddie, you know, I'm not saying that he could have done much different or that he did a good job with him or anything early, but nobody could have succeeded with when all those guys were struggling at the plate in the first half. And that wasn't Freddie's job. You know, that was, well, the player's number one, but Seitz was working hard with him. He couldn't get any of them turned around. It was amazing how many guys were struggling. You never had more than one guy that was even close to hot at any given time. You never had two or three, much less like it was in a second half when like six guys were hot at once. It was crazy that they all turned it around. They all did. I mean, none of them, you looked at all the season that had, and nobody, none of the prominent guys had a bad season. You know, from Adonis Garcia to Nick Markakis to Freddie Freeman to Anciarte, Jace Peterson comes back from AAA, and all of a sudden he's a different player. Adonis Garcia comes back from AAA. He's a different player.
Learns how to hit and how to field when he comes back.
Yeah, learned how to field while playing left field. He comes back and plays right. Third base. Like, flip the switch. Right? It was crazy. So, but yeah, people would say, you know, you must be counting down the days. I'm like, really? This team's kind of a, you know, after that first stretch, and then, you know, and especially after the first couple of weeks of Snicker, it was a, they were an easy team to cover. They never were negative. The guys never had that us against them mentality that some club lefts have with the media or the outside world. They never had that. And I think that's a big credit to the leadership in the clubhouse. I mean, guys like Freddie Freeman that set the tone and are respectful of the job we have to do. And they don't start pointing fingers at people outside and saying fans are idiots, you know, off the record, that kind of stuff. The younger guys take their cues from those guys. You know, the Nick Markakis is the handles things really well, just goes about his business, keeps his, you know, Nick called me out one time when I wrote a column right before Freddie got fired. I wrote, you know, what manager could succeed with this team? You have maybe two guys on it that would be elite players. If one guy that's an elite player and two or three others that another team would even have on the roster. And he ripped me a new one in the clubhouse one day in a corner of the clubhouse, told me he didn't appreciate it, all this stuff, and that the negative, you know, and I respected him for how he handled it, how he took me aside, took me to a corner, cussed me out, but did it quietly and didn't try to make a show out of it and show off for his teammates. And I said, you know what? Now I see what, like Kelly Johnson talked about, what a leader this guy is. Cause I hadn't seen it before. Cause he's so quiet, you know? But when he takes a guy aside or, you know, behind closed doors, stands up in front of the team meeting and speaks, when he takes you aside and looks you in the eye and talks, you listen. So I saw a different side of him that day, and I understood what people had said about him being a leader with his intensity and all that. So I just saw some good signs. And then once Snit took over, it's like they all took a deep breath and they said, look, the 9-28 start is what it is. We're not going to overcome that. We're not going to, you know, compete for a playoff spot, but what we're going to do henceforward is play every day hard. Like it's you know, the only game we have and we'll see what happens. How the chips fall. And they did that. Which, you know, usually it's just a bunch of cliches and teams don't do that. And they inevitably spiral in the second half when they realize, let's just get through this season. You know, this is a no win. There's nothing to play for. They never had that mentality, which was amazing. They played harder down the stretch than all these teams that were fighting for playoff spots.
Yeah. Oh, against the Marlins. It was, you know, pretty clear against the Marlins.
Yeah. I mean, in a team like,
The
Nationals were fighting for home field advantage in the playoffs. They still had plenty to play for.
Yep.
And the Braves, who could not beat them for so long, for the last couple of years, win a series against them. That was big as far as the Nationals' positioning and all that potentially. And the Mets were fighting for a playoff spot. Now, I know they were beaten up, but they still had a whole lot more talent healthy than the Braves did. And, you know, our people would say that they did based on the record and all that. But the Braves throttled them. You know, swept them. So they impressed me down the stretch. It was no doubt a great vibe in the clubhouse that you usually see from teams that have had a great season, not from a team that's in last place ever. You just don't see that.
Yeah. All right, David, we'll finish up with this. What two teams you got in the World Series?
Well, it's hard to pick against the Cubs. I was kind of hoping the Giants would do it again for that story, the even number year and all that stuff. But the Cubs just have too much firepower, and they're too balanced. And Madden is a hell of a manager, and they're healthy. They're healthy, which is big. So I'll take the Cubs. And it's difficult to pick over in the AL. But you know what? I'll go with this. I'll go with Cleveland, because when Cleveland came in here midseason, or before the All-Star break, whenever it was, and they swept the Braves, I think they did, or they won 3 out of 4, whatever that series was. They dominated the series. Yep. I came away, I told everybody then, Cleveland's the best team I've seen all year. And the Braves had played the Cubs at that point, and I was more impressed with Cleveland's balance, top to bottom, rotation, bullpen, and lineup. And great manager, too, Terry Francona, that handles a talented team as well as anybody. And what I've seen in the playoffs so far has reinforced that view that I had of them. So I'll take Cleveland and the Cubs in the World Series. Be a great World Series.
You want to pick a winner?
I'll go against the grain and say Cleveland. It'll probably be the Cubs, but I'm going to go against the grain and be able to say I picked Cleveland.
Well, the year of Cleveland would be a fun story.
Oh, it would be. Well, I hadn't even thought about that. But, I mean, everything says it should be the Cubs.
Yeah.
So, usually when everything says it, I tend to go the other way. So, but Cleveland's, they got a hell of a team, man. And they're on a run now. Yeah, and now, Believe Land, right? That's right. What they're saying, Believe Land?
That's so, right.
Yeah, we'll see. But I'll take those two in the World Series.
All right, David. Great, great stuff as always. Everyone, please read David throughout the offseason at the AJC and on Twitter. David, seriously, a pleasure as always. Have a great winter, and we'll speak to you soon.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
So let's discuss our thoughts on the Roger McDowell firing, but first, a quick break. So, Hammy, obviously we talked a lot with Dave O'Brien about Roger. Thumbs up or thumbs down on the move for you?
Thumbs up on the move. I think it's more of a personal move for me, too. I just never could get behind McDowell. All the stuff that he did, the things in San Francisco, and all the stories about him just being a Class A jerk, it was hard for me to get behind him. I know that there was some success. I think there were a lot of pitchers that did well by him. I think you could argue some didn't do so well by him. So I don't think I really criticize him for the job he did as a pitching coach. But it didn't certainly stand out enough in my mind that it made up for the stuff, the personal reasons why I didn't like him. So I'm sort of glad to see him gone. I think it's a good opportunity to turn the page, as it were. I'm interested to see who takes his place.
Yeah. Curtis, how about you?
Yeah, I'm the same. I think the biggest criticism that sort of developed around McDowell is that he can't really develop young front of the line pitchers. And certainly that is the situation that the Braves are in right now, that those are the guys that are going to be coming along in our system. So we really need somebody, whether it's Marty Reed or if it's somebody that Bud Black brings in, whoever it might be, that really is good at working with the young starting pitching. I mean, he did great things with like Aaron Harang and guys like that, and maybe even guys
Jim Johnson.
Medlin was really surprised and supportive of the help he had gotten. Peter Moylan, guys like that. But you look at also Jair Jurgens, Tommy Hansen, some of those guys that were really our aces of the future that flamed out pretty quickly. The struggles of Aaron Blair and people like that this year, Whistler. So I think it was probably time for them to move on.
Yeah, I think it makes a ton of sense on paper. You've got this huge pipeline of young pitching. The front office has decided that that's not his strength. So you bring in someone else. Hopefully it works. You know, he certainly did a lot of great stuff here. It wasn't 100%. And hopefully the new guy can really bring that talent along.
Well, and like DOB said, we don't have any reclamation projects. We've got the guys, hopefully, in place. It's now just time to make them win. And it feels like McDowell maybe isn't best suited for that. So it's exciting. I'm excited for this new chapter so much.
So, Curtis, it is time to revisit that fateful day in March, earlier this year when we made some predictions for what would happen for the Braves in 2016, as well as the postseason that's gotten underway. So let's take a walk back through it.
Yeah, and always these are somewhat hilarious and enlightening in hindsight, and sometimes, you know, sad that the way things didn't really play out. But in this case,
there Angels.
Some, yeah. Hector Olivera.
Save it, save it, yeah.
Yeah, so our first one was looking at Freddie Freeman and how many games he was going to play this year, because, of course, we were all concerned about his ability to stay on the field. So it was over and under on games played for Freddie Freeman of 158. Ham and I, or sorry, the number was 130. He actually played 158, but Ham and I both went under on 130. Steve, you went over, so you won that point. Yes. Over and under on home runs hit by Hector Olivera of 12.
Oh. Now I don't remember. How many did he have?
Ham and I went over.
So did DOB, for the record.
DOB went over. Yeah. Steve, under. Wins another point. Over and under on Frenchie's batting average. I only did this as a Brave because I really don't care what he did as a Marlin. Ham, monster, went under. Steve and I both went over, got that point. Because he batted 249, for the record.
What was the over under?
245. Over and under on Tehran's ERA, the number was 375. We all went under, as did Tehran, with a 321. Over and under on runs scored by the team of 613, which we threw as the number the Marlins scored last year, which was second worst to Atlanta's 573. Ham, both you and I went under. Steve went over. He was right. They hit six. They scored 649 runs this year, so a nice step up. Which starting pitcher would end the year with the best ERA? We all went Tehran, which, although technically not true, because the starting pitcher that ended the year with the best ERA was Cole Minter. He only had two starts. So Tehran, with his however many starts he had with his 321, was the logical conclusion, and we all got that right. So over and under on Braves wins was 74. We all went under. They ended up with 68 wins, so we all get that point. So I will point out at this point, Steve, you got every single one of your predictions correct.
Wow, Stevie.
Wow.
You should do a podcast. Now,
yeah, and now on the converse of that is your division and World Series picks.
Which all right, so Kurt, no, I will bask in the glory of how wrong that is. I do want to add that for the Marlins, Jeff Francoeur slashed 280, 333, and 360.
Uh-huh.
So Jeff kind of hit for the Marlins.
Yeah, nice work. So he would have been over if I had bothered to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, much better numbers than he had in Atlanta, except for slugging. He slugged a little more in Atlanta. All right, Curtis, the postseason.
And Ham, you would have still been wrong there.
Yes.
So AL East, Ham went Sox because he's a homer. Steve and I both picked the Jays. The Sox, of course, won the East.
Homer are just smart. I'm not a homer, by the way. I'm from Atlanta. Everybody out there. Maybe I'm just smart.
The AL going, Central. Angels. The AL Central, we all picked the Royals, who didn't even make the playoffs. Of course, it was Cleveland. This is where it gets hilarious. AL West, Ham picked the A's. I picked the Angels. Steve's only correct prediction for division winners went with Texas, which was a nice pick. Wild card, Ham picked the Jays, which was correct. Nobody else got it. We sort of picked some teams that made it, Red Sox, but of course they won the division. ALCS, for some reason, the only one that made a pick for this was Ham, and it was Royals Jays, so obviously half of that is wrong. NL East, we all, I was about to say, all went with the Nats, except for Steve, who picked the Mets. NL Central, we all went with the Cubs, except for Steve, who picked the Cardinals. NL West, another great pick by me. Ham went Dodgers, which was right. I picked the Diamondbacks. Steve
you
went
and
with
their,
the
you and their front office.
Yeah. So, you know, I was really rooting for that Angels D-backs World Series, and they ended up, of course, being two of the worst teams in Major League Baseball this year. So
who did I pick in the NL West?
The Giants. So they were a wild card team. Wild card, Ham went with the D-backs there, fell in love with them as much as, not quite as much as I did, but almost as much. Cubs cards, so-and-so. NLCS handpicked the Nats and the Dodgers. Obviously, that can't happen because they're playing already.
God, so I want the Nats to lose so bad in that series. So bad that I'm actually rooting for the Dodgers, which doesn't feel good. But
it's
really.
Tied one and one all, right?
Nats won today.
The Nats won today, yeah.
So World Series, obviously, still to be determined, but Ham is really the only one that has any shot. He has Nats, Jays, with the Jays winning the World Series. I had the Angels playing the Cubs with the Angels winning the World Series.
If they would have made the postseason, they would have given the Cubs all they could handle.
Totally. If they had won more than 57 games, they totally would have been there. And Steve went with the All-Missouri World Series, Cards, Royals, Cards winning it all. So the grand total, Ham, you were talking about Steve blowing us out on this, but because he did so poorly in his division World Series picks, you tied, Steve.
Oh, nice. Now, so, if the Jays win,
that's true, and you can still win.
That's right.
So you still got points on the table to have. All right. Steve is in the clubhouse with an 8. You have an 8. I have a 7, and I'm done. So
now that we know stuff, Curtis, who do you got in the World Series?
I think it's the Cubs.
Yeah, facing who?
I will go with the Blue Jays.
Yeah, that's my pick as well, Hammy.
I'm going to stick with the Jays because I picked them early. And I think I actually feel more heartened by them than I did as I was tracking through the season. They look really good. The Cubs look awesome. I think it's going to be Jays-Cubs. And that's a lot of pressure on the Cubs. So I'm going to stick with the Jays. Jays over the Cubs.
All right. So, guys, it is the end of the season, and we would like to thank everyone who helps make all of this possible every year. Our web guy and our producer, Mike. Our blogger, Sean, our graphic designer, Mike, our wives, of course. All of you that listen, of course, we cannot thank you enough. And Kurt, Hammy, thanks again for another great year. This was, you know, when this thing started, we thought it was going to be a real, real slog. And, you know, the Braves turned it around and gave us some stuff to talk about.
They did.
And to enjoy, you know.
And hopefully we have a lot of good shows to do in this off season because there's big decisions coming.
Well, and that's right, Ham. So tonight marks the end of our weekly shows for the off season, but we will be back throughout the off season as big developments occur. I assume there will be one or two. And that is the show. So everyone, please remember to find us at our new home of Blog Talk Radio, as well as iTunes and Stitcher. And as always, you can find us at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com to access our shows, to check out our blogs, and to post in our comment section. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at ATL Baseball Talk, and to like us on Facebook. Thanks again for listening, everyone, and go Braves!
Thanks for listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves. To find new shows, to post in our forum, or to send a comment, please visit us at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com.